My approach is going to be a little different from Amy. I'm going to share my writing philosophy and some of the mechanics that I go through when I try to publish a paper. And so there is a big difference between collecting data and doing something with that data that somebody else actually is going to want to read at some point in the future. And a friend of mine once gave me what I still think is one of my biggest professional compliments. He said, "You get more information out of your data than anybody else I know." And I thought that was really great, because isn't that actually why you're collecting data? It's not to have data, right? Data is great, but you need to translate that data into something useful. So we'll try to talk about that a little bit. First of all, why publish? Well, first of all, if we don't publish, then science is dead. So we need to obviously get our information out. And that can be a scientific publication, it can be an extension publication, trade, doesn't matter, but we need to share what we do. But for you as graduate students, what you need to do is you have to build a reputation, right? Because you probably want to get a job after you graduate. And I think publishing papers is a great thing, a great way to do that. And I, even after publishing over 100 papers, I still find it exciting when I finally see my paper in print. So I think it's just a really rewarding thing to do. But one thing that you should think about, in my mind, when you start publishing, it is not just about getting that line on your resume. Ultimately, to build that reputation, you want your papers to have an impact. So publishing it is one thing, but you should try to write your papers in such a way that other people might actually want to read it too. Wouldn't that be nice? And you don't really know how many people read it, but if nobody reads it, it's still a line on your CV, but did it really make much of a difference? So with most of my grad students, at one point, typically fairly early on in their graduate student career, I have this conversation. All excited at this point. Not so excited anymore. Oh, I didn't mean to do that. So I have a lot of data loggers in my lab. They collect tons of data. Not one of my data loggers has ever gotten a graduate degree. So getting data is nice, but that's not what the science is, right? The science actually, data is a part of it, but in many cases, just a small part. So if you want to go write a paper, well, when do you think you need to start writing a good paper? Hopefully not option D. Hopefully you start thinking about your paper before you do anything else, right? Because if you don't plan in the design of your study, then it's probably going to be a major problem later on. So you really need to think very early on, assuming that everything in your study works out the way you hope it will. Sometimes you get that lucky. You can write a quality paper. So you need to have really clear objectives. What are you trying to do? What data do you need to answer the questions that you're asking? And then you can design your study. And you need to think about, do I actually have the resources to do what I want to do? And if you do, go ahead and do your study. If not, don't do it. Rethink what you actually need to do. I have a discussion with someone in my lab who will not be named here today, but about every month he says, "I really, really, really want to do this study." And I keep saying, we don't have the infrastructure to do it right, and there is no point in doing it poorly. So I keep telling him no. So I'm going to talk about the different parts of a paper, and this is going to be a little bit repetitive because I want to approach it from different angles. So the anatomy of a paper, you all know, it starts with the title, right? That title is pretty important, very important actually, because if you have a title that doesn't attract people's attention, then your paper is probably never going to get read, because that is the first thing other people see. So try to make sure that you have a title that is actually going to get people's attention. And so if you have a good title, then hopefully you can get some people to go ahead and read the abstract. So that abstract really needs to pull people in. Because if your abstract is boring, people are probably not going to read the rest of your paper. So think about that very carefully. You need to have a hook in your abstract and get people hooked on what you're doing. And then in the introduction, I'll get back to this, but you need to explain why your research actually matters. Pretty important. Materials and methods, I typically find those to be pretty boring, but they are really important. And there is a very simple standard for what a materials and methods should be. Other people should be able to read it and repeat what you did. And that's really what you should keep in mind. Results, description of your data, sometimes combined with the discussion. I cannot write a results section and then a separate discussion section. My brain doesn't work that way. So I always mix those two together. But for other people, it works better to separate them. That's entirely up to you. And then the conclusions. If you have a conclusion that needs multiple paragraphs and citations, then they're not conclusions, right? Conclusions should be really short, to the point, and I think we should require, and we don't, that conclusions are written as bullet points. This is conclusion 1, 2, 3, and not conclusion 1 through 8, because that's the last thing people see, and it needs to be the take-home message of what you did. And people are not going to remember more than 3 things about your paper. So the chronology of how you write a paper is very different from the anatomy. I think that you should start with doing the materials and methods. As you are doing your study, it is so easy to write up your materials and methods as you are doing things. You know exactly what you're doing, you don't forget anything, and if you wait, it's going to be a problem. So for the results section, what I really like to do is just make a ton of graphs, and that's before I do any statistics or anything, but I may have 20 graphs taped to the walls in my office, and I stare at those things, and I ask myself, what's the story that I'm trying to tell here? And based on that story, which of these graphs do I need? And then a discussion where you try to put it in the greater context, and then you write the introduction. Don't start with the introduction. Why not? Because you don't know yet what you're actually introducing. So do it at the end. Well, actually, don't do it at the end, because the last thing you're going to write is the abstract. If you start off with your abstract, then it's probably not going to match what is going to be in your paper. And finally, when you have all of that, now you come up with your title and figure out, how do I get people to actually open this PDF and read what I did? So I mentioned the materials and methods. I really stress this to my students. Really write as you're going along. I know from experience, and I've replicated this many times, by the way, that if you don't write things as you do them, you're going to forget relevant details. And I don't care how careful your notes are. Something is going to be missing, and you will not remember exactly what you did. So do try to make that a habit. And so now you have data. So this is data. What does that tell you? Nothing. I mean, my students know this, and this is definitely just my opinion. I hate tables, because what can you see in here? A lot of black and a lot of white. Right? So you have lots of data that you collected in your study, but now you need to figure out, what am I going to do with that? What does it all mean? So you get your data, and you make graphs. I don't care what kind of graphs you make, whatever makes sense for your study. And these are not the graphs that are going to go in your paper, or most of these graphs probably won't, because it will turn out that most of these are not the best way to actually tell your story. But make graphs, tape them against the wall, and literally just sit there and think, how do I get my message across? So that means you need to know what your message actually is, right? It is really good to think about these data and figure out, what can I actually conclude from this? And then you backtrack and decide, okay, given that these are my final conclusions, I need to include these data in my paper to be able to lead my readers along to reach the same conclusion that I did. So lots of graphs. So there are 2 kinds of graphs in my mind. So this is a descriptive graph that shows how much radio-labeled, or actually carbon-13 ended up in cuttings. Doesn't matter what the study was about. But it is very descriptive of what happened over time in different treatments. So this is going to provide information to your readers. And many cases, that graph may look like this, with time on the x-axis, or you might have your different treatments on the x-axis and your response variable on the y-axis. And these graphs are important, but in my mind, in many cases, the most interesting graphs are not graphs that are purely descriptive, but that help you interpret your results, that help to explain what actually happened. And one thing that you need to keep in mind when you start making graphs and when you present your data, I don't care about all of the data you collected. I really don't. I know you spend a lot of time on it, and students often have a really hard time accepting this, but all I want to know is what I need to know to get your message. So you probably have a whole bunch of data that you spend a lot of time on and that you really want to show people, but it's not relevant to your conclusions. In that case, in my mind, you have to make the hard decision to just get rid of it. Because if it doesn't help the readers, it doesn't need to be there. So one thing that I try to spend a lot of time on when I interpret data with my students is, what additional information can we get out of this? So this just shows with the data points the graph of root dry weight over time. So a very simple thing that we could do with this is actually calculate the root growth rate from that as the derivative of the regression curve. So now we have a new variable that we were able to determine from the dry weight data. So it's something new that can help me interpret the rest of my data. And then you start looking for relationships, or at least that's what I do, among the different things that you collected. And in my mind, this is where we go from just descriptive data to providing new knowledge. These things are related to those things. So this is an example using the root growth data that I calculated in the previous graph, and it turns out that in cuttings, the rate of root growth is very nicely correlated with the photosynthetic rate. So I was actually really excited when we looked at these data and we found this relationship. So we ended up submitting it to the ASHS journal, and the reviewers didn't like it as much as I did. They actually said, we really like your data, but you need to include two more treatments in your study. And we go like, we need to do what? Does anyone have a time machine around? I mean, this was somebody's PhD project, and we were not going to completely repeat somebody's PhD. So I still like this data, because in my mind this was a meaningful relationship. It helped us to explain what happened in this study. And that meaningful is underlined and in bold and in italics for a reason, right? Because it's really easy to find relationships. If you collect enough data, there's all kinds of correlations. And did you know that the number of crude oil that we import from Norway is very tightly related to the number of people who die at railroad crossings? Isn't that interesting? No, not really, because obviously that's completely a fluke, right? A very strong correlation. So I often, first of all, there is one thing that I don't like about this graph, the way the data is presented, regardless of what the data is. But when you're talking about correlations, what do you think would be a good way to present your data? You plot one against the other, and you add a regression curve to it. That shows the relationship, right? Here we have the number of people who died by railroad trains and crude oil over time. It doesn't show the relationship between the two. So in my mind, rather than presenting things this way, you should plot one against the other. So this is actually, I think, much better. And it turns out that the average global temperature is very closely related with the number of pirates. I think this is one of the most famous examples that statisticians use to explain that correlation is not causation, because it's highly doubtful that there is a meaningful relationship here. But it's highly significant, in case you were wondering. I mean, you can tell. Right, but these kinds of graphs are more common. And one thing that as a reviewer I see a lot is that people say, basically looking at a graph like this, those two parameters were correlated with each other. And then they don't do a regression analysis. I always get out my don't use a pen for reviews, but well, if you're going to say that they're correlated, at least do a regression analysis and show me that they're correlated. It's the simplest statistical analysis you can probably do. So you get to this discussion where you're going to describe what happened, but more importantly, why did this happen? At least as a physiologist, I don't really care about what happened. I want to know why. And if there is no why in the paper, then I'm probably not going to be all that interested. So what new knowledge are you contributing, and how does that fit into the existing knowledge? And if you're really lucky, sometimes it may contradict existing knowledge and you found something that is really exciting. If that's the case, just make sure that you build a really strong argument for your somewhat contradictory results. And one thing that is really easy to forget is make sure that your discussion actually matches your introduction. And that's one reason that you probably should not have written your introduction yet. But sometimes you read papers and the introduction is about one thing, and by the time they wrote the discussion, they forgot what the introduction was, and the discussion is about something entirely different. So you have to make sure that they match. And in your introduction, you need to have clearly stated objectives and hypotheses, and then explicitly address those objectives that you had somewhere in your discussion. And then I like to raise new questions, because in many cases that helps me justify the next research project that I want to do. We have learned this, this, and this, but it raised this question. And then that means that's probably the next study that we are going to do, or in some cases that we already did but haven't published yet. And then I've talked about the conclusion already. Just keep it short, because otherwise I don't think it's a conclusion, and it's not going to have a whole lot of impact if it's too long. And now you get to the introduction. So I'd like to start off with the really big picture. Why does this topic matter? We're going to save the world. Well, and then you funnel it down. What do we already know? More importantly, what do we not know? And why does it matter? The knowledge that is missing. Why is it relevant that we learn more about it? And that helps you to get to the objectives of your study. So they call this kind of a funnel approach, where you start with a very broad introduction and you narrow it down to your specific objectives. And then the very last thing that you really need to write is an abstract. In some cases, I see abstracts that don't have an introduction. People go straight into what they did, or maybe even straight into the results, without explaining why they did it. And that makes it really difficult to get that hook that is going to catch readers. Because if the reader doesn't know the background, there's a good chance that they don't understand why you did it, and they may not be all that interested in reading the whole paper if they don't have enough background. But other than that, it basically has the same components as the rest of the paper. I like to keep my materials and methods really short. I never say, and during the study we measured X, Y, Z, all of this stuff. Why not? Because if I say in the results part of the abstract that photosynthesis was affected by this, it's obvious that I measured photosynthesis, right? So just telling readers all of the things you measured doesn't convey any useful information in my mind. So I like to save as much room as I can for the results and discussion and as little materials and methods as is possible. So this is really important, right? That abstract really needs to grab readers, because otherwise your paper ends up being in line on your CV but will not have any impact. And then finally, I've talked about the title already. Try to make sure that you have a title that is going to capture people's attention. Because in many cases, a lot of people will only see your title. And if that title isn't interesting, they won't see anything else. So this kind of illustrates that funnel idea that I mentioned, where you take an introduction, you bring it down really narrow, your results are pretty narrow because they are tied to your very specific objectives that you had and the things that you measured. But in your discussion, you can go back again to the bigger picture that you have for your study. How does your research actually fit into that really big, maybe a global issue? But try to put it in a much larger context than just your own research, the literature in general in that topic. And again, just to reemphasize, make sure that the discussion and introduction actually match each other. So once you have your paper ready, you send it to your major advisor, and within 2 days, he or she is going to turn it around with comments or not. Hopefully, in a timely fashion, it will come back to you. But that proofreading stage is really important. And I really have to reemphasize what Amy said. Try to get the paper in as good a shape as you possibly can. I had a graduate student, she just finished a few months ago, and she complained about how slow she was with writing. But when she sent me a draft paper, it was in amazing shape, and I could edit that whole paper in an hour, and there would be some changes to be made, and I would give it back to her, and when the second version of that paper would come to me, I would go like, well, I think we should probably put a comma here. And it was done. Two rounds of revisions, with the second round being trivia. Amazing for me, because I knew that when she sent me a draft, it wouldn't take me forever. I had another graduate student who will definitely remain nameless. When he sent me his first paper, I open up the file and I start reading and I go, oh my, what am I going to do? And we literally started working on the introduction, one paragraph at a time. It was painful for both of us, and it took us forever. I mean, he got better at it, but when he sent me his second paper, I wasn't overly keen to open up that document and start working on it right away. But make sure that people proofread it. And I do want to emphasize this point. You are the worst person in the world to proofread your paper, because you know what you were trying to say. So you have all this background knowledge, and your advisor is the second worst proofreader in the world, because hopefully your advisor knew what you were doing and also has a lot of background knowledge. If you have an advisor who is clueless, then your advisor may be a good proofreader, because if they're out of touch, it's not an issue. But it is really difficult to proofread your own paper. So at some point, it is really helpful to have someone else read your paper. And then when you think it is in great shape, if you have the time to do it, if you set it aside for a month and reread it, you will probably notice that it wasn't in quite the same great shape that you thought it was. You will see new things, because now you have forgotten some of the stuff that is floating around your brain as you're writing, and you reread it and you think, this is not nearly as clear as I thought it was. So there is a lot of rewriting that typically has to happen. And so again, make sure that you get, or try to get other people to proofread your paper. And preferably not your best buddy who is not willing to be critical, because then it's not very useful, right? We've had a discussion about this in a task force that I'm on. It's really difficult to get someone to give you a critical review of a paper who is willing to say, that's crap, that needs to go, or this makes no sense. But that's what you need. And then when you submit your paper, my preference is option C. More than half of the papers submitted to ASHS journals get rejected. And you don't want to be part of that. I think it's 60%, Neil, is that right, roughly? So you really want to have your paper in the best possible shape that you can. And be careful with publishing your results somewhere else before you submit it to a scientific journal. You are not allowed, typically, to put this in a trade journal and then in a scientific journal. I see it a lot, but typically that is frowned upon. And if you submit poor papers, it is going to hurt your reputation, so you don't want to do that, and you're wasting everybody's time. I'm going to skip over the peer review process, and Neil can definitely comment on that later on if you have questions about it. But keep in mind that many papers don't make it, at least at the first try. But when you get your reviews back, let's hope that your paper got accepted without changes. Actually, let's hope that's not the case. I think I have had maybe two papers that were accepted without changes. That was not because my paper was that good. That was because that journal was that bad, right? Trust me, I don't write perfect papers. So if you're lucky, your paper gets accepted with revisions. Sometimes your paper gets rejected and you are asked to resubmit. And then the question is, what do you do? So you look at the comments that you get from the reviewers and you decide, can I actually address these comments? So that paper that I mentioned earlier that got rejected, where the reviewers wanted us to add retrospectively two more treatments to the study, well, we decided not to resubmit that to the same journal because we couldn't add those treatments that the reviewers wanted. But in many cases, that resubmission is very feasible if you pay attention to what the reviewers are actually asking you to do. And hopefully, in most cases, I think reviewers have good insights. I mean, there are a fair number of reviews that are iffy, I would say, but you typically get at least one or two good reviews with constructive criticism. And then if your paper is rejected outright and they say, don't ever come back to us. So now you have some thinking to do, because what are you going to do with that paper? You may still want to publish it, so you need to decide, are the reviewers actually right? Is my paper as bad as the reviewer said it was? Is it publishable or not? Or should I just run it through the shredder and forget about it? Hopefully that's not the case, but sometimes that happens. But in many cases, maybe you need to just look for a different journal that has a different focus, and that can work. Or in some cases, you may be able to do a follow-up study to address any holes that you may have had in your paper to begin with. If you do resubmit to another journal, do address the reviewer's comments anyway. Actually, one of the papers that I reviewed faster than anything else was a paper that I rejected for the ASHS journal. And a week later, I got the same paper from Scientia. No changes. So I got my review that I did for the journal and sent it to Scientia and said, here's my review. It's still the same poor paper it was last time. They didn't make a single change other than formatting before they resubmitted to another journal. It got rejected again. But the bottom line is, struggle through it, and it can be a struggle, but you can do this. And it is really rewarding. I remember still how I felt when I saw my first paper in print. That was a very proud moment for me. So with that, I don't know if we have time for questions.
We don't.
Okay. I'll be around.